Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now, a detention hearing is being held today for two of the three Ohio men accused this week of plotting to attack U.S. troops in Iraq. Mohammed Amawi, Marwan El-Hindi, and Wasim Mazloum lived in and around Toledo, where there's a sizable Muslim community. They're accused of studying how to use suicide belts, how to build roadside bombs, and one of the men is accused of plotting to kill President Bush. All three have pled not guilty, but a mysterious Muslim informant called the Train apparently led investigators to the suspects. Joining us on the line is reporter Mike Tobin. He's with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Mike, who is this trainer?
Well, that's the great question everyone wants to know. As best we can tell from what we've gathered, he was a black Muslim, not of Arab descent, and he served in U.S. military special forces. And he was from the Toledo area, lived in the Toledo area, and as far as we can tell, these guys approached him and asked for help, which started more innocuous than you know, jihad, mm-hmm. but help with basic training, self-defense, that sort of stuff. And it apparently progressed, and the guy who's identified as the trainer in the indictment, he at some point goes to the FBI and expresses concern.
We understand he was enlisted by the FBI. He watched these men for over a year, traveled with them?
Yeah, he basically worked as an undercover agent for about a year and a half. And the trainer actually went to Jordan with Amawi, one of the suspects. And, you know, our understanding is there were daily updates, and they were constantly being monitored.
Well, and tell us about these suspects. They seem to have been fully integrated into American life. Two studied at the University of Toledo. They ran car dealerships, a travel agency.
Right. Amawi was, as best we can tell, he was born here, but had dual citizenship in Jordan, where he was arrested, and he has some family over there. Studied briefly at the University of Toledo and worked at a travel agency. El-Hindi worked at a different travel agency in Chicago, and Mazloum is a computer science student at the University of Toledo, had been since about 2001, and he and his brother owned a used car dealership.
Well, you know, we want to be clear. It's alleged that they've plotted against American troops. They were allegedly learning how to build suicide belts and downloading information about bombs that they wanted to allegedly bring into Iraq. But they are not accused of plotting to attack sites in the U.S.
That's correct, and that's sort of the odd thing. Why would you go through the all the logistical nightmares of getting to Jordan, getting into Iraq, shipping, you know, all sorts of things over there, and not target, you know, the shopping mall down the street? As best we can tell, there were no plans for domestic terrorism. Amawi was charged with two counts of threatening the president, but it's unclear just how serious those threats were.
Well, this is the second time this week that Toledo has been hit by terrorism allegations. On Sunday, the U.S. Treasury Department froze the assets of the Toledo-based charity Kind Hearts, accusing it of funneling money to the militant group Hamas. How are people reacting?
Well, the community itself has sort of shut down. They're not saying a heck of a lot, which I think is sort of understandable. You know, the town was basically overrun by reporters for the last few days. You know, everybody that we've talked to has sort of said what you hear in these sorts of things. Didn't suspect a thing. Seemed like normal guys. Can't fully believe the accusation.
Well, and they come, and these arrests come as the president defends his warrantless wiretapping program. Have investigators said anything about whether any of the information gathered by the trainer was gathered from surveillance that was done without a court-approved warrant?
Well, that's interesting. The Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, refused to answer the question. The local U.S. attorney and his assistants said that all of the information was gathered by, quote-unquote, traditional law enforcement techniques, which sort of suggested that these warrantless wiretaps were not used, but they wouldn't come out and say that specifically.
Mike Tobin, a reporter with the Cleveland Plain Dealer, where a detention hearing is being held today for two of three Ohio men accused of plotting to attack U.S. troops in Iraq. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, on this Friday, a conversation now with a writer who's actually more accustomed to talking about other writers. Gail Caldwell is the Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic for the Boston Globe. After several decades of reviewing other people's books, she's just written one of her own. It's a memoir called A Strong West Wind, and she begins it by asking a simple question.
How do we become who we are? The question belongs not just to genes or geography or the idea of destiny, but to the entire symphony of culture and its magisterial march, to Proust's Madeleines and Citizen Kane's Rosebud and anyone's dreams of being someplace, anyplace else. I was a girl whose father had taken such pride in her all her life, even when it was masked as rage, that he had lit a fire in me that would stay warm forever. I was the daughter of a woman who, on a farm in East Texas in the 1920s, had crept away from her five younger siblings so that she could sit on a hillside and read. A mother whose subterranean wish, long unrevealed, was that I might become who she could not. Each of us has these cloisters where the old discarded dreams are stored, innocuous as toys in the attic. The real beauty of the question, how do we become who we are, is that by the time we are old enough to ask it, to understand its infinite breadth, it is too late to do much about it. That is not the sorrow of hindsight, but it's music. That is what grants us a bearable past.
Gail Caldwell reading from her new memoir, in which she looks back on a life spent with authors like Harper Lee and Mary McCarthy, Camus and Leon Uris, on the floor of the Amarillo, Texas Public Library, or under the covers reading by flashlight. In fact, it's a book she started as a book about books.
Well, I sort of tricked myself into writing this book because of books. I really wanted to write something autobiographical, but I had long believed that my life was too boring, too run-of-the-mill. I did not have an exciting childhood by any stretch. I grew up in the middle of a wheat field in many ways. And because I'd spent so much of it escaping through reading, I thought to myself at a critical time at the beginning of this book, I thought, well, I could always write about how literature had influenced my life, which seemed to me to be much more sort of exciting and profound than any of the day-to-day elements of my childhood. And when I started mapping out that course of action, it turned out that there was a lot more in my memory bank than I had given myself credit for. So it began as a sort of critical glance backward at the great books that had influenced me and wound up being much more of a memoir in its own right.
Well, let's start with your story, because the one thing that is distinct is that you were born in Amarillo, Texas, and as you say, in the middle of a wheat field maybe, and that landscape shaped you. Tell us about that. Tell us about the strong west wind.
Well, I think that it must be like water is to people who grew up on the ocean. You assume it so much as the sine qua non that you don't think about it until you're gone. Mm. And I had brief bouts of living in San Francisco and then moved to the East Coast when I was 30. So I think it was only after being away from the panhandle for a long time, and I would go back to see my parents who lived there for most of their lives, that I was struck by the harsh, overwhelming reality of the landscape. Mm. And I was the granddaughter of farmers on both sides who had come from East Texas, but Texas itself is so vast by comparison to most of the rest of America. And I think that if you're a child growing up in that landscape, even though I grew up in what would now be called the suburbs, it was a small town, and so they were houses that were next to each other on big old sprawling lots. Mm-hmm. The houses themselves are specks compared to the horizon. And so if you are a child or anyone coming of age, I think, in that landscape, your elemental feel about your place in the universe has to be somewhat humbled.
And you want to know what's on the other side of that horizon.
You do when you finally get old enough to consider that. For a long time, I think you don't think there is anything on the other side.
Right.
I mean, we are not all born Galileo, so you start off going, well, this is it.
Right.
And it can be, I think that's a hard thing to struggle with, because it's an absorbed kind of feeling about the land and the climate, and only after you start to realize, for me it was through books, that there is a world beyond it, do you want to
to take flight.
Right. And you ultimately did. But before that, you write in particular, at least I took, how that landscape shapes women in particular. And I'm thinking of the title, The Strong West Wind, mm-hmm. and Blowing Back the Hair.
Oh, you may be thinking of the legend of the pioneer women who I said walked out into the wind, that there were always stories that I grew up with about women living on the frontier who couldn't bear the sound of the wind and nothing else. And I always remember this from a child. I mean, other people remember Edgar Allan Poe or Alfred Hitchcock stories. I remember the story of the woman who laid down her broom and walked out into the wind and was never seen again.
Yeah.
And to me, that was like the ultimate horror story because I knew it could happen.
And on the other hand, you were a woman who did also walk out into the wind.
This is true.
And went to college in Lubbock, Texas, a little bit further over. And we want to talk about this because this was another sort of seemed like a benchmark in your life. We said you'd been daddy's little girl, loved your father, who was a World War II veteran.
Adored my dad, yes.
Read more World War II books than probably anybody. And then became part of the anti-war movement.
Yes.
So many women are going to identify with this.
I think so, yeah.
Tearing away from dad. Tell us about that.
Well, I called a friend of mine who's a poet when I was working on the first part of this book about reading Leon Uris and Herman Wouk. And I remember being, I don't know, 9 or 10 and lying on the floor of the Amarillo Public Library immersed in World War II novels. And I thought, as we all do when we look back on our past, we assume that what we did was universal. And I called a friend of mine and said, did you think all girls read war novels when they were little? And she laughed and went, oh, right, everyone did, Gail. And I realized that, in fact, that probably wasn't true, that a lot of girls had in the 50s and early 60s had other icons to look toward. I think because, for whatever reason, my father was incredibly modest and dismissive of his time in World War II. He was a master sergeant for 3 or 4 years overseas, but he was not in combat. And it was simply a part of his mystique to me because I was the adoring second daughter. So I think that I probably read and immersed myself in war stories simply because they were part of who I knew him to be.
And how much did it pain you, looking back, as you do in a memoir, on your life, that this father that you adored, you had to disagree with when it came to the split over the war in Vietnam? I mean, you protested it, and he was for it.
It didn't pain me so much in writing about it because he and I had such a long and, I think, wonderful relationship until his death. We had a lot of years to get over the fissure that, in fact, existed between us for probably 10 or 15 years.
As you said, he had a long life, but he did pass, and it mm-hmm. becomes a bittersweet a chapter in the book about seeing him, this World War II vet, in a veterans hospital with a sweet, gentle Vietnam veteran in the same room, rubbing his back at night when he had nightmares. You wrote about that, what it was like to witness your father that way. You said an ancient feeling, like watching an elephant fall and die. Tell me more about that.
I don't know if I can. That feels to me to be exactly the way it felt.
Well, we'll continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic Gail Caldwell. We'll hear more about losing her father and the very recent loss of her mother when we come back. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from our interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic Gail Caldwell. Her new memoir is called A Strong West Wind, and we thought we were going to be talking with Gail more about her late dad, about the books that shaped her. But just before we spoke, Gail's mom also died. She was incredibly gracious to come in, and as you'll hear, to talk about her more recent loss. We're so grateful that you're here.
Thank you.
Because we understand your mother, who you dedicate the book to along with your sister, mm-hmm. Also recently passed.
She did. She died last month at the age of 91.
Can you tell us about her? If your father was the wonderful, noble elephant who died, who was
My mother was the leopard who was able to stand up to the elephant, I guess. God bless her. She was a very, in many ways, traditional woman who believed in the sanctity of being a stay-at-home mom in a small town in Texas and was horrified when I hit adolescence and became an anti-war sort of starlet and then came home with mask the goodwill uniform of the women's movement and the anti-war movement.
Sure. Do you have a pea coat and work boots, combat boots?
Combat boots and an old army jacket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet there's a point in the book where you realize there was something. Would you mind reading to us about what you came to feel about your mom?
The people we love best are always mysteries. Sometimes the truth resides in what we cannot see or do not know how to look for, the songlines written on the land that hold the stories that precede us. A couple of years after I had left Texas, when it was too late to turn back, and after I had survived in the East long enough to call it my home, I phoned my mother to say that, for the first time, I had made enough money as a writer to list it under occupation on my tax return. "My mother and I both wanted to be writers, you know," she said matter-of-factly. "I'm glad one of us finally did it." In all the years I had blundered along in search of my own footing, she had never given me an inkling of this wish. Unburdened by the demands of history or anyone else's dreams, I had wandered toward and finally reached a world far outside the plains I had loved and loathed. My mother had neither begrudged me this journey nor expected it, certain that I had to make my own way. But she packed my toolbox with her great wit and forbearance before I went, and she stashed there for long safekeeping her desire.
How amazing to find that out so many years later.
My mother was very good at being understated and sort of dropping bombs that she didn't think would have that much impact, that were just all part of the story for her. Mm-hmm. So, and I actually think it's a great gift that I didn't know that for many years, because it would have given me a whole different sense of, I mean, I probably would have gone to law school if I'd known that, or become a biochemist or something.
Talk about getting in the car and leaving those people and coming to New England to be a writer.
I mean, well, you know, I think I was too young to know any better in a way. I mean, I look back now and I think not so much about the difficulty of leaving, because I think that is a universal desire and plight. I actually feel sorry for the people who grow up in New York and have to go to Chicago or Peoria or someplace to get away, because I think it's easier in a funny way when you grow up in a place you don't want to make your home in. And Amarillo was not a place that beckoned to me by any stretch. I mean, I couldn't wait to get out. So I think in that way that however good our relationship was, that my mother in particular had a sense that it was the right thing one did was to leave.
And that takes us to the writer part. You know, physically leaving the place was one thing, but it was also to become a writer. You who were so steeped in the great writers, that's pretty brave.
It was brave, but I also think that it had that lovely naivete of the innocence of youth where you just don't know any better. And, I mean, truly, I had the idea that I wanted to be a book critic, which now I think is also an odd little aspiration. I thought most people had it.
And a couple decades later, a Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you, yes.
Gail Caldwell, we know how difficult this time must be for you, and we are so grateful that you're with us. And given that your memoir is really about your parents, what is it like now to be without them, without your mother, the woman who shaped you so much?
I don't know if I can speak articulately about this yet. I mean, I will try to say a few things, because, in fact, I think I know that this is universal. If you're lucky, if the world works in the right order, we're supposed to bury our parents. And I also think that I was fortunate enough to have had the years that it takes to form a good, solid, finished relationship with each of my parents. So I utterly believe in Freud's dictum that you get them back if you do the mourning in the right way. And I know that that's been true with my father. I came back actually the week after his funeral in 2003, and my noble and fairly selfless mother said to me when I left, "Go home and write your book and do it for Bill," because I was in the middle of this when he died. So I think that that sense of freedom and a sort of integrity that they probably tried to give both their daughters is what you move on with. It doesn't make it easy, but it makes it bearable.
You were saying that you wrote your mom's obituary.
I did, and I never, you know, I've known people who've tried to do that before who are journalists, and I never could believe that they did. And in fact, it was a fairly simple and joyful task for me. After we had named her survivors and the date of her death and everything else, I began the sort of story of her life by saying, a petite woman who stood 5'3", Mrs. Caldwell was nonetheless the captain of her high school basketball team, taking them all the way to the state championship in 1932. And I could hear her. I could imagine her saying to me after it ran, "Oh, honey, I can't believe you put that in the paper." But in fact, it was one of the things that I was able to do. So it's the image I have of her. Mm.
Gail Caldwell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Boston Globe and Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic Gail Caldwell. Her new memoir is called A Strong West Wind. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and
It's Here and Now. The sounds of Sunni and Shiite Muslim men praying together at a joint service in the Iraqi city of Basra today, a welcome sign of unity in a week marked by some of the worst violence between Sunnis and Shiites since the U.S. invasion. The Iraqi government has a rare daytime curfew in place to help stem further attacks, and the government is sending more troops to the most tense areas. So far, upwards of 130 people have been killed, mostly Sunni Arabs, in retaliation for Wednesday's bombing of the revered Al-Askariya Mosque in Samarra, one of the most sacred sites for Shiite Muslims. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said today that other Arab states now fear that the sectarian violence in Iraq could spill over into their countries. What was it like for Shiites to see the image of the Gold Dome Mosque in ruins? Hamid Dabashi is a scholar of Shiite history at Columbia University in New York. Professor Dabashi, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We know that this site is the burial site of two of the most important Shiite imams or saints. Is there an analogy in other faiths for what it means that this mosque was bombed?
Yes, of course. In all religions, you have had these sacred sites. I would say, for example, Jerusalem or Vatican, if we go to Christianity and Judaism, or even in the secular context, I would say the closest thing would be to consider, God forbid, the White House, the Capitol Hill, the Independence Mall in Philadelphia, things that have historical resonances with us. And as a result, they have references, for example, to the founding moment in our history.
What did you think or feel when you saw the television pictures?
It is extremely sad, I mean, because these sites have assumed symbolic significance for people around the world, regardless of the fact if they are practicing Muslims or not. Muslims throughout the world have grown. Whether they are Sunni and Shia is really, at this stage, quite irrelevant. What is important, these sites have assumed extraordinary iconic significance. I would be as sad if I were to see, God forbid, if Vatican, if something is done to Vatican or to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem.
Well, we understand that although Samarra is a Sunni city, Shiites travel to this mosque to worship at the tombs of the 10th and 11th imams, and also the site where the 12th imam disappeared. This is the hidden imam.
We need a little bit, not too much, just a little bit of history. As you know, the Shiites began to secede from the overwhelming majority of Muslims who are Sunnis in the 8th and the 9th century. The doctrinal difference between the Sunnis and the Shiites is the assumption that after the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, the Shiites believe that a succession of saintly figures, and they are presumed to be infallible, followed in after the Prophet Muhammad in leading the community of Shiites. Despite the fact that they are minority compared to the overwhelming majority of Sunni Muslims, in the three major countries in the region, in Iran, in Iraq, and in Lebanon, they are majority. There are divisions within Shiism. There are 5 Imami Shiism, 7 Imami Shiism, and 12 Imami Shiism. Depends how many Imams do you believe it has happened. The overwhelming majority of Shiis are 12 Imami Shiis. The significance of an Askari mausoleum is that it is referred to three last imams, namely Imam number 10 and 11, and then also is the site that she is believed the 12th Imam, al-Mahdi, disappeared. The disappearance of the 12th Imam is a doctrinal belief in a second coming. That is the closest thing that we can find, for example, in Christianity, is the second coming of Christ, mm-hmm. namely the coming back of a savior to restore justice in the world.
And that would be the 12th Imam, the hidden Imam.
Is the hidden Imam. And doctrinally, she is believed that he is alive and well and present, but he is in occultation, he is in hiding.
Well, and they believe that this imam will come back, that's what, over 1,000 years after he disappeared.
Exactly.
And
they still
make the pilgrimages to this mosque to pray for his return. Professor, what happens now? We understand the mosque itself was built in the 10th and 11th centuries. The dome was added in 1905, the gold-plated
exactly.
dome.
Yes.
What happens? Do they put the dome back on?
Yeah, I mean, historically, nothing of this proportion has ever happened. But the restoration of these domes are acts of piety that powerful Muslims and kings and monarchs and such have done it as an act of piety historically. So there is no doubt that this will be restored. I mean, I've been trying to find out what precisely are the extent of damage to the actual burial sites, which is not hard to tell. But there's no question that the building will be rebuilt, that already there is a team of architects and such at work trying to assess the extent of the damage that has been done and how it will be restored. It will be restored. It is also very important to keep in mind that, yes, these sectarian divisions do exist in Iraq, but Iraq is also a nation. And nationalism is very strong, especially under foreign occupation, that those sentiments of nationalism obviously become more evident.
Professor Dabashi, one last question before we let you go. We all saw the violence following the bombing of the mosque. You know, thousands of people taking to the street, protests attacking Sunni mosques. And there's protests in Iran as well. Outside of Iraq, Shia are protesting. It becomes what journalist has called the big blur. And to many Americans or Westerners looking up, they just see this big blur of an angry humanity. And it blurs with the crowd that was furious about the Muhammad cartoons, for instance.
Exactly.
You know, it's hard for Westerners to distinguish what really is sacred. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But I think for those of us who live, say, in the United States and in Europe and see these horrid pictures coming, violence and explosions and such, we really need not, Robin, restore to some medieval doctrine that separated the Sunnis and Shiis. They are important, but more important in my judgment are the immediate historical context of how and when this new cycle of violence was initiated. And that goes back to Donald Rumsfeld's campaign of shock and awe. That's English. That's not Arabic. That is not medieval. That is not Shi'i. That's American English. When you unleash this incredible amount of violence in a country, no matter what country it is, there are consequences to this violence. One has to go back to the source of violence. Who initiated? This is not to defend the horrid despotism of Saddam Hussein, but to begin at a moment in history when unfathomable violence was unleashed on a country. They have endured, even prior to this occupation, a period of economic embargo that resulted in 500,000 Iraqi kids being killed. So one has to put what is happening in Iraq in the immediate historical context, in immediate geopolitics of the region, rather than some medieval doctrine that separated the Sunnis and the Shiis.
Hamid Dabashi, a scholar on Shiite history at Columbia University in New York. Professor Dabashi, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And still to come, here in Boston, Maestro James Levine's Schoenberg concerts have audiences leaping to their feet in ovations. So he asks, why do people think they don't like Arnold Schoenberg? You're listening to Here and Now. Ravens, they're normally thought of as birds of bad omen, think Poe. But at the Tower of London, they're considered lucky charms. The large jet-black birds are treated like royalty because legend holds the Kingdom of England will fall if the birds abandon the 1,000-year-old tower. So this week, as a precaution against the threat of bird flu spreading across Europe, the six ravens who normally roam the Tower Green were taken inside and placed in quarantine. Derek Coyle is the Tower's Raven Master. He joins us from London. And Derek, tell us more about this legend that the ravens are lucky for the kingdom. Where did that start?
The legend really goes back to the reign of Charles II. There were lots of ravens here in his day, and they were making an awful mess of the place. And the Tower residents asked the king whether or not we could get rid of all the ravens. Initially, the king agreed, but then he was reminded of the old legend that if all the ravens ever leave, the great white tower in the center will crumble and fall, and great harm will befall the country.
Oh, boy. Well, how do Londoners feel about their ravens?
Most people in England are very familiar with the legend of the ravens, and most people that's visited the tower since they went away have asked why, and when it's been explained to them why, they're all in full agreement with it, and they've said thank you for acting so quickly.
Yeah, and you're acting because of the fear of the bird flu. We note that South Korea today is reporting its first cases of bird flu in humans. Ireland is ordering 400,000 doses of a test vaccine against the deadly virus that causes bird flu. So far, the virus hasn't been detected in England, but we understand you're taking further precautions in addition to moving them. You wear a special suit?
Well, it's not a special suit. It's just a normal bio suit that any forensic scientist would work would wear, or indeed people who work in labs. We have got the birds in complete isolation. The only people who are allowed into where they are is myself and my three assistants, and even then, we put these special suits on. We've got masks and gloves, and we actually walk through a disinfectant bath. So we know we've been as careful as we can.
And tell us again why. I mean, some might say these are just birds, and you don't really believe that legend, do you? I mean, why all the care?
If I didn't believe the legend, who would? I'm the Raven Master. I've got to believe in it.
Yeah. But by the way, what are their names?
The six here, their names are Thor, Moonin, Gwillem, Hugin, Baldric, and Branwen.
What were they named after?
Well, Branwen is a Welsh Celtic name. It means white raven in Welsh Celtic. Baldric was named after a character in the Blackadder series. Gwillem was named after that because he came from Wales. It's a good Welsh name. Hugin and Moonin are Norse names, as well as Thor.
What are they like? Those of us who've had birds know that, you know, birds can become quite your friend. But what are these birds like?
Oh, they've all got their own different personalities. Some are more bolder than others. We have a raven here that talks. He'll carry a conversation on with you. He's quite intelligent. They'll play with each other. We did have a raven here called Reese. One of his tricks was if there was a young girl with long hair, particularly tied up with ribbons, if she bent down in the big fountain on Tower Green to get a drink of water, Reese could be up there as quick as a flash, have the ribbon out of the hair, and he'd dash under one of the little grassy greens and just rip it up.
And we understand then there was also George, who, as we read, had an unhealthy taste for TV aerials.
Yeah, well, yes. In fact, it's very hard to sex ravens, and when a raven came to the tower, we just gave him a name. George was named after a coast guard in Anglesey in Wales. When we retired George through to his little tricks with the television cable, he promptly took up with another raven in the Welsh Mountain Zoo, laid an egg, became known as Georgina, and the product of that egg is here now. He's Gwillem.
Well, there you go.
So Gwillem's mum was here, masquerading as a male.
Well, Derek Coyle, a raven master for the Tower of London, they've removed the six ravens and put them in quarantine because of fear of the bird flu. Thank you for telling us about this, and I'm on behalf of bird lovers, thanks for taking care of them.
Oh, thanks for your concern.
And by the way, our thanks to the website naturesongs.com for the raven sound. And by the way, these ravens, they're commoners. They were recorded in Arizona. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. It's Here and Now. That's Boston Symphony Orchestra music director James Levine rehearsing Arnold Schoenberg's Pelias und Melisande.
Look at me once. Look at me without delay. Do it a touch louder, but a touch warmer, right? I don't want to get any glare from asking you for a little bit more.
James Levine is on a mission. He's devoting at least part of 10 concerts to Arnold Schoenberg, the Austrian-American modernist who's been called the most misunderstood composer of the 20th century. Talk about a tough sell. More than 700 subscribers have turned in their tickets because they want more comfortable fare. Well, I caught up with James Levine just after rehearsal and asked him, given that, why Schoenberg?
Oh, why not? It's one of the greatest things, and it's not played often enough for new audiences to get a chance to hear it. Schoenberg was the most pivotal composer of the 20th century. He was, in a way, the most remarkable. There was wonderful music written in the 20th century by a great many other composers. But the one who advanced the whole idea of what music could be and succeeded from every musical and artistic point of view was Schoenberg. And he was, to his century, in various other ways, as significant as Beethoven was in his century. See, it's now very difficult to play a lot of Beethoven close together. It gets cloying. And it's difficult to play a lot of Schoenberg close together because the orchestras are only partly familiar with his music, and then you need a basis on which to find enough rehearsal time, etc. And you need a public who has a sense of adventure, who's ready to go to a concert for reasons other than hearing something they already know and having a memory experience.
Well, you say he's the most pivotal composer, but he's a composer that has adjectives in front of his name all the time. He's also been called the most maligned. Why is he so controversial?
I think it isn't any more controversial than any other great music was when it was new.
Schoenberg created atonal music, 12-tone composition. There's a way you can demonstrate. Can you sing that? Is there a way to say what that is?
Yes, I think we should forget that. I think that has been another source of the problem. Music, you can talk about music till you're blue in the face, and if you want to understand music in terms of how it's composed, what its content is, then studying music is a good idea. But talking about music is the kiss of death, because you're using words to describe something which is much weaker described in words than the music itself is. And Schoenberg, I think, if you heard a piece by a composer, you didn't like it, and the next thing you heard was, well, he changed the whole face of music. You'd say, well, I wish he hadn't because I like my Tchaikovsky symphony. The problem is new things require a commitment on the part of the listener to get familiar enough to be able to make an intelligent judgment about whether they want to hear it again or not. But the crucial thing in absorbing new art is always the second encounter. It doesn't matter if it's a novel, a short story, a painting, a film. The first time you see it, you see it. But if you go a second time, you're amazed at what you missed. Don't do anything until the day of the concert. Just don't do anything. Take care of your family, take care of your job, you're fine. When you go to the concert, get there 45 minutes early so you can sit quietly in the lobby and read the program notes. Now comes the performance. And the important thing is, if you don't like what you hear, change your frame of reference, because whether you like what you hear or not is not the point. The point is to hear it. And many people are so busy fighting with it, they don't really hear a thing. Mm-hmm. Everyone's memory is short. They forget that everything we take for granted in music today that is easy to understand and old was controversial when it was new.
What did you hear when you do I understand that you used to play Schoenberg when you were younger?
Absolutely.
What did you hear in it? What got you?
same as got me into the Second Mahler Symphony, same as got me into operas by Berg. It was complex, but so fascinating and so beautiful, and such a huge range of emotion and of musical discourse, musical thought. And the more I knew it, the more I loved it.
As you well know, people are saying that James Levine, he's crazy bringing this, you know, complex Schoenberg, when, as we know, some subscribers, hundreds of subscriber ticket holders have turned in their tickets. But on the other hand, crazy like a fox, your eyebrows shooting up because your single ticket sales have shot up. Is this another way of bringing in younger people, which orchestras have to do?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's what's happening. But I have to tell you, don't be deterred too much by the people returning tickets. I think it's great that a person who's sure they don't want to hear that concert doesn't spend the money on it. I, however, feel very sorry that people are hoodwinked in a way to stay away from it when without really having ever made contact with it. And I think that's a pity.
And be a little brave.
Yeah, in a way, it is curious how agitated people get over something as if it were World War III when it's really a presentation of a piece of music. I don't understand their lack of curiosity. I don't understand people who seem to like to be able to say, well, I don't like it. If I knew a composer who had written for Verklärte Nacht, the Chamber Symphony, the First String Quartet, the Gurlieder, and then all of a sudden he wrote the Six Little Piano Pieces or whatever, and I didn't get it, you can bet I would spend a lot of time trying to get it, and I wouldn't give up on it so easily. I once had an experience which shows what I'm saying. I conducted the New York Philharmonic in Zemlinsky's Lyric Symphony, which was either its American premiere or its New York premiere, I don't remember. Each time I chanced to look to the first fiddles to my left, I could see somebody leaving. Now, this piece takes 40 minutes, maybe 45. And I thought, people, do you really know what you're doing? You paid money to eat dinner in a restaurant. You paid money for the babysitter. You paid money to park the car. You did whatever you did. You don't want to sit there for 45 minutes and find out what this is, not even once?
Wouldn't it be funny if someday it'll be, oh, Schoenberg, been there, done that.
It will be. It will be.
Boston Symphony Orchestra Music Director James Levine. You can read more about the BSO's Schoenberg program and tour their online conservatory, as well as visit our arts blog at our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.